Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast. Welcome to the channel, and thanks very, very much for being with me today. I just finished talking with Jan Kiley and Brooks Jessup about their new edited volume, Recovering Buddhism in Modern China. This came out in 2016, just this year, with the Columbia University Press. Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast. Welcome to the channel, and thanks very, very much for being with me today. I just finished talking with Jan Kiley and Brooks Jessup about their new edited volume, Recovering Buddhism in Modern China. This came out in 2016, just this year, with the Columbia University Press. Now, what you'll hear us talking about in the hour to come includes attention to the gathering that produced the volume, the transformation from a kind of conference gathering to the book that we are talking about today, but also some of the major themes that animate the contributions to the volume that also motivate some of the, I think, really important historiographical work that the volume does. So among those themes, you'll hear us talking about the significance of integrating a closer and more careful, but also more expansive attention to the significance of religious practice and religious life to modern China, to the making of the modern Chinese state, to urban life as an aspect of that, to how we understand local history, and much, much more. You'll all also hear us talk about the importance of social communities to that process. Especially when I talk with Jan, you'll hear us talking about the significance of particular kinds of archival discoveries and archival records to shaping the kinds of stories that we can tell about all of these things and their implications. So this is very much a volume that is devoted to, among other things, opening up how we think about the relationships between religion, modernity, history, China, and everything in between. So I think it's a really fascinating volume. We just barely scratched the surface of what you'll find when you actually pick up a copy and explore it for yourself, but this should hopefully give you a sense of some of what you'll find there. So it's a quite extensive interview, so I'll leave it there and let you get right to it. And just to say thank you for listening, for the support of the channel that constitutes, and I hope you enjoy. I definitely did. I'm here today to talk with Jan Kiley and Brooks Jessup about their new edited volume, Recovering Buddhism in Modern China. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Jan and Brooks. Thank you so much, not just for writing a really interesting and I think important volume and for being here with me to talk about it today, but also for navigating many time zones in the process. I really appreciate it, and welcome to the podcast, both of you.
Thanks a lot, Carla.
Thank you so much, Carla.
So let's start with the traditional question of the channel. How did you each come to work on China, and why Buddhism in China specifically? And Brooks, maybe we can start with you.
Okay. Well, for me, actually, the Buddhism came before the China. I was a religious studies major as an undergraduate. And when I was looking for study abroad programs, I was interested in a program that involved sort of practice as well as sort of classroom instruction. And the program that I came across that I became interested in was a Buddhist studies program in India. And so my interest in Buddhism kind of grew out of that, the Antioch Buddhist Studies program in Bodh Gaya. And then after that, sort of coming to China, I have to give credit to Tom Wilson, who was a teacher of mine as when I was an undergraduate, who basically really challenged my sort of whole approach to thinking about religion and thinking about Buddhism as well, which had been in sort of a comparative religion mode, challenging that with a more historical approach. I found this not only challenging, but really sort of a fascinating different way to look at religion. And so I ended up in a lot of his classes. And he basically converted me not only to looking at China, but also to history as a discipline. And so that's really where it all started for me.
And Brooks, what are you typically working on when you're not editing volumes about Buddhism in modern China?
So this project is related to a monograph project that came out of my dissertation as well. That's focused on Buddhist activism in Shanghai for basically the first half of the 20th century in the Republican era. This volume is something that for me was really sort of came out of the interests and insights from that larger project. And in addition to that, there's also, of course, teaching and other kinds of fun responsibilities as well.
Of course. Thank you so much. And we'll talk a little bit about that work when we talk about your single-authored contribution to the volume in a little bit. So Jan, same question for you. How did you come to work on China and why Buddhism specifically?
So complete reverse. I got into China very young as a teenager. My parents went to China when I was in 1982. I went to Chengdu and went to school as a high school student. That's how I got into China. I've never sort of gotten out of it since then. But I was very, very resistant to not only Buddhism, but to religion, to studying religion. And for me, it was really an epiphany in the archives, which Burks knows about, where and that's why I've actually gotten so into this project, where I was so convinced that the archives must be wrong, because I couldn't believe that the Buddhists were as influential as they were saying. And it was by finally realizing that the evidence was just piling up against my own prejudices that I realized that this was something really important that had been overlooked. And that's what has brought me into it.
Great. And we'll talk also about the importance of archival findings when we talk about your single-authored contribution to the volume. So Jan, similar to what I asked Brooks, when you're not editing volumes or talking at 1 a.m. your time with a podcaster who's keeping you up way past any normal human bedtime, what are you typically working on?
Well, I've done some. So my first book was on thought reform in the prison. And I've been working a lot on religion recently. But actually, I think, as I've told Brooks, I really think his book is so important. I sort of don't feel I have to write my own book now on Buddhism. I'm going to do a few more pieces that I have planned out on Buddhism. But I'm now part of a comparative local history project on the 20th century that uses the historical anthropology technique. So I'm working here with David Vohr and John Lagerwey. Mm-hmm. A few other scholars. Mm-hmm. We have an 18-member international team, and my own project is centered in northern Jiangsu, and I've never really done a lot. I've lived a lot in China, so I've sort of informally done field work. But as a archivally trained historian, I'm now trying to combine a documentary study with field work. And so I've been doing a lot of field work up in that part of China. And it's still in a very early state, but I'm finding out a lot of interesting things. It's been fun.
Great. So let's talk about the genesis of the volume. You both talk early on in the volume about a workshop at the Chinese University of Hong Kong in May 2012 that kind of gave birth to what eventually became the volume. So let's talk a little bit about that. Perhaps, Brooks, we can start with you. How did your involvement in that workshop come about? And can you tell us a little bit about whatever was notable about that process before you moved to actually putting the volume together?
Sure. Yeah, the workshop was wonderful. And I think the idea was initiated by Jan. So I think he'll have a lot more to say about that as well. As Jan was just describing, I mean, in his earlier work, the sort of discovery of Buddhists in the archives, that when I read that chapter of his dissertation, it was very inspiring for me as well. So I had met Jan when I was doing my field research in Shanghai. And so he contacted me about the possibility of doing this conference. For me, it was just very exciting to sort of be along for the ride and do what sort of learn from Jan, actually, and figuring out how to put this together and how to move it through the different stages that a conference organization needs to go through. And so I thought that the actual workshop itself was great. I mean, one of the ideas that we'd had was to, because sort of one of the aims of the project from the beginning was to help this emerging scholarship on Buddhism in the modern period speak to a broader audience, and more specifically to sort of historians in the broader field of modern Chinese history, we had invited a number of scholars who don't necessarily work on Buddhism to participate and to comment on the different papers. And I thought that was a really excellent way to sort of bring the conversation in directions that really, I think, helped Jan and I in sort of thinking about how to sort of shape the volume that came out of the conference afterwards. The whole setting and the whole setup in Hong Kong at the Chinese University of Hong Kong was also just a great place for everyone to get together. It was a great experience.
Jan, did you want to add anything to that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think it really started with just about the time that I met Brooks. So Brooks and I both were at the history graduate program at Berkeley, but quite far apart in time. So I just had heard about his work right around the time that I was starting to move into. In fact, right at the time that I was starting to do the archival work for this chapter in this book, I heard about Brooks's work from our professors at Berkeley. And so then I was able to meet him, and I was, you know, I don't want to overly gush about Brooks here, but it was really exciting, honestly. I mean, I was still, you know, a young assistant professor trying to find my way through a topic. And it was great to meet somebody who knew what I was talking about and who had really been doing some terrific work in the archives on it. So it was an immediate, I remember we went, just had Brooks, what was it? It was like a lunch or something. Anyway, it was just very, you know, it's just a lot of fun to talk to people who really get your obscure fascinations. And so that was terrific. And I realized I'd met somebody who I should really stay in contact with. There was a few other scholars that I knew. The other one that was very significant to my idea here was a scholar named Xue Yu, who's also in the volume, mm-hmm. Who's a fascinating figure who was a former monk and very, very connected in Chinese Buddhism, has been trained in various seminaries and also in the U.S. as a historian. And so we'd done an AAS panel, and I think it was 2007, and we wanted Brooks to come to that. And we were sort of getting the ideas together. I thought something was starting to happen, especially in the Chinese scholarship at the time. And all of us, of course, could talk about Holmes Welch, who was kind of hanging over all of us as the source that everyone went back to in English, but with the strong sense that something more had to be done. And then I got waylaid for 3 years to go to Nanjing to be co-director of the Hopkins Nanjing Center. So I just couldn't do really almost anything in that 3 year period. Though I think I kept in some touch with Brooks. I don't know if you remember, but when I got to here to CUHK, I very early on realized this is something I wanted to get back to. And of course, Shuiyu is my colleague here. So we were talking about this all the time. And when we finally got the grant money and got ourselves organized and everything, that it was terrific to try to figure out how to do it. And immediately, of course, I contacted Brooks. And what was really important for me and what I think is terrific about this, not only is there a certain amount of very important scholarship going on in China and Taiwan, and Brooks was completely on top of this, but Brooks had a great network of younger international scholars that he knew, and immediately sort of opened my mind to their work. Mostly it was in the stage of dissertations and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so I really wanted to get that group together. And of course, there are other people we'd hoped to get involved as well. I mean, we were all really influenced by Ralph Birnbaum at Santa Cruz. He was a tremendous figure in this field. And had kind of actually had known many of these monks that we talk about, and had arrived in China early enough to tap into a lot of what was left over from the Republican period. Unfortunately, he was unable to attend, but otherwise, I thought we got together a terrific group. And for me, I'm not sure how everybody else feels. I think doing these types of conferences where everybody's coming together for a purpose, but we all came, as you can see from the volume itself, we're from all over the map. And disciplinarily, what we're actually looking at, our approaches to research, theoretically, everything. And throwing that particular salad together for me was terrific fun, because we also knew enough about the same sort of things that we could have great conversations. But I was learning throughout it. So for me, it's been it was a great experience.
Now, it can be as exciting as it is to bring such a diverse array of people together into a common conversation. That can also be a challenge when you're actually moving to editing the volume itself, right? But this worked out really, really well. And so let's talk a little bit about that process. How did the process of actually collaborating on compiling and editing the volume together, how did you make that work? Was there anything notable about that process, or sort of anything you'd want to share about really the practicalities of how you went from a collection of conference papers to the volume that we're talking about? And perhaps Brooks, we'll move to you first.
Sure. So in this process, I was really kind of following Jan's lead. Jan has a lot of experience in these kinds of projects before, which was proved invaluable. Mm-hmm. So one of the things we did was we got together right away while I was still in Hong Kong, right after the conference, to sort of hash through some of our ideas. And that was one of the best. That was one of the best sessions, I think, Jan. That was a really productive conversation. We were really charged up after the conference, and I thought that a lot of sort of good insights that went into the introduction sort of came up there. The sort of notable aspects, I guess. I think one of the things. So we were trying to bridge a few sort of artificial divides in this emerging subfield. And one was to bridge, as I sort of mentioned before, what's sort of always been a question for me in my own work, and that is sort of and as Jan was mentioning earlier as well, sort of how to bring out this topic of Buddhism in such a way that although you know we obviously think it's important for a number for many different reasons, to how do we bring that to sort of a broader audience outside of religious studies. So that was one of the sorts of things that we were thinking about. And the other, another one for me was that to bridge the divide between sort of the study of contemporary period and what where Jan and I focus in the early 20th century, although Jan's work has moved across the 49 divide recently. But to sort of bridge the contemporary scholarship with that of the early 20th century was also something we were trying to think about. So, I mean, that just came up in terms of titling. I mean, we were originally thinking about 20th century, but we realized that no, we can't do, it would have to be a very long 20th century. Mm-hmm. So sort of rethinking sort of how we periodize this and all the rest kind of went into that process. So I think one of our main focuses was to try to get each of the pieces, which were, sort of coming from different sides of this divide to speak to broader audiences, and to speak across disciplinary and temporal, or periodization divides. And so one aspect or sort of notable aspect of the revision process had to do with kind of making suggestions and going back and forth with everyone on those kinds of questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And is there anything you'd like to add here about kind of what you felt was notable or important about the process for you?
Sure. I mean, I think Brooks is being a little too kind. I mean, I don't have that much, don't have that much experience with this. I've been on the writing end in some volumes, and I'd been part of a big project, Modern Chinese Religion, two volume series that I was doing almost around the same time. Mm-hmm. These are difficult actually projects, but I felt extremely fortunate, not to kind of extend the sense of the bromance here, but I think.
Oh, extend it. Extend it. We love bromance on the podcast.
You know, I think it was just really terrific to work with Brooks. I mean, I actually hadn't really fully figured out in the early stages how I was going to do this. And it was just, I think we complemented each other pretty well. I probably drove him pretty crazy at times. But for me, the best part of it was always, in fact, Brooks has covered a lot of it now, but it was just the long conversations that we got to have about all this, not just at the workshop, but then what rolled out of it. And many of our long-distance Skype calls we were supposed to do something very practical, but we'd end up getting into some big conversation about something, some topic. And for me, that, you know, that's great fun. And I learned a lot. So it's very, very interesting. And it's a very valuable part of this whole exercise to me. You know, to be totally honest here, doing these volumes, I think, is really painstaking and hard work. And Brooks has heard me complain about it enough. I just think it requires a lot of detail-oriented work. I'm sure you know this yourself. And there, it's a very long road. And working scholars often, at least in my own case, are, I think most of us can be very individual and have our own ways of doing things and our own sense of how everything should be. And there has to be a lot of give and take. So I don't think it's always easy to produce it, but I was very glad that I was able to be part of this project.
So let's actually get into it, and I'll take us through some of what's happening here in the introduction. So early in the introduction, you both mentioned that Buddhism and Buddhists played important roles in, and this is in the words of the book, modern transformations of China's 20th century, and this continues today. Now, at the same time, history scholarship has, at least relatively speaking, kind of neglected to pay attention to the important roles of Buddhism in these transformations. So I'd like to talk a little bit about how you both feel about why that is, right? Why has there been this relative neglect, and why is that changing now? Because I think we see also that change happening across many different subfields right now of East Asian studies and Chinese studies. So let's talk a little bit about that. So broadly, why the neglect and why is that changing now? And Brooks, perhaps we'll start with you. What is your sense of this?
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons. One of the reasons that we focus on in the introduction a bit has to do with the fact that the Cultural Revolution happened, right? And so it was fairly common view that China was, if not the one of the most secular nations, right, in the world. Coming out of the Cultural Revolution, there was that kind of an idea. And so if you're sort of to the extent that particularly history of the modern period, it needs to explain sort of where we end up, that sort of presentist bias in modern history, then, religion and in general, and Buddhism in particular, doesn't really take you that far in terms of explaining sort of where you end up with the most secular nation in the world. So I think that, in that earlier period, it was in the 80s and perhaps even into the 90s, that still had an effect, because what's happened is obviously the changes sort of on the ground in terms of what's referred to as religious revival in all its many guises in the PRC, of course, but then also the explosion of Buddhist organizations in Taiwan since the mid 80s, and also Hong Kong as well. That has led to a lot of scholarly interest that I think just wasn't there earlier, and so there's been sort of a process of rediscovery of what happened, right, particularly before 49, and how that links up with what's going on today. So I think there's that. I think there's also related to that is the fact that, some of the earlier paradigms with which we thought about, modern Chinese history, whether it was sort of the revolutionary paradigm or a more sort of Weberian modernization paradigm, that those kinds of approaches were, sort of inherently, built into that were sort of secular assumptions, but also sort of left religion on the side. So I think those are some of the reasons, although I think you could probably talk about more, and perhaps Jan has some other ideas as well.
Great. And I'll just highlight before we turn to Jan that one of the things that you just mentioned is a kind of revivalism. And this is, in fact, one of the main themes that the introduction talks about in terms of highlighting some of the major contributions of the volume as a whole and of its contents. That is the importance of rethinking Buddhist revivalism, and specifically revivalist projects of clerics and laity that helped make Chinese religion and Buddhism in particular more legible to the modern state. And we'll talk a little bit more about the significance of Buddhism for understanding the state and the modern state in particular in China in a little bit. But Jan, how about you? For you, can you speak to this? Why the neglect of Chinese Buddhism in scholarship on modern China, and why is that changing? Yeah, anything that you'd want to add here?
Yeah. So as I started out with at the very beginning, where I was just so surprised. I think having studied with a lot of very significant scholars in the field, from Ying Shi to Jonathan Spence and Frederick Wakeman and so forth. That I was being so surprised by what I was seeing, and that I was so expecting it not to be significant, says a lot about not only the historiography, but the types of sources that we were exposed to and that were available for a long time. And a lot of this has to do with not only what Brooks has been talking about, but longer standing trends going back to the early 20th century and various types of secularism and the Chinese nation state construction and May 4th secularism and Nationalist Party efforts and so on, Communist Party efforts early on. And so all of this combined to not only create a situation where even the earliest works trying to recognize the significance of religion, just any kind of religion, any kind of major force in 20th century China was also, relatively thin in its content. And that has only begun to change in the last 10 years. I mean, I really think in kind of the period that we were beginning to think about this, then there was a lot of work that was beginning to come together, but very little about Buddhism. So, one thing that really motivates me in a project is when I find something I can't find any explanation from, I can't see anywhere that anyone's written about it. So I really want to dig more into it. And that's exactly what happened in this case.
So Jan, let's stay with you and talk about some of the other, or I'll just mention maybe one other important theme that the introduction of the book brings out that links a lot of this work together. So we've talked about the importance of rethinking Buddhist revivalism. And another key theme is the encounter of and with Buddhists and Buddhism with the modern state, right? And you talk about the importance early in the introduction of understanding Buddhists and Buddhism as part of larger histories of nationalism, nation-building projects, and the modern state in modern China. So do you want to speak to that a little bit? And specifically, what might it be important for listeners to know about this connection between Buddhism and the modern state that might not otherwise be clear without the volume?
Well, I think we were building on a certain amount of work, certainly out of Rebecca Nettestop and Vincent Gosar, David Palmer, that was coming out right around the time that this work was being developed. It was very much putting the state, the modern state as it was developed after 1911, particularly to some extent in the very end of the Qing, at the center of a story of restructuring the definitions and categories, boundaries of what is thought of as religion itself in China, and creating certain normative structures for that, not as a complete project, but as a kind of guideline and model. And so we were aware of this as we were going along. I think in our own work, we definitely see this as a very fluid process. And most of us are in this project are working with many non-state actors and many Buddhists in society. And so their relationship to the state has many multiple forms. And in some of my earlier work, what astonished me the most was how much particular Buddhist activists were in one respect taking on actual roles within major state modernizing state institutions, which are very surprising. In my case, looking at prisons, but there are many types of institutions in which especially judicial institutions where Buddhists were very active. But in fact, that is extended, and I think Brooks's book is going to bring this out more, and there's more work coming out on this, and I'm interested in this subject as well, but also, for instance, charity, philanthropy, various types of organizations that have a very significant role in major urban civil society development, have a strong, not just religious flavor to them, as was recognized before, but a heavily Buddhist one in many parts of China in this period, and interact very fluidly with the state, and are constantly interacting with the state in ways that are negotiations that are attempting to achieve many kinds of results. It's not a simplistic sort of suppression, non-suppression model. It's not an attempt to legitimize themselves for no other purpose. They, of course, come up with their own theories for how they're working in relation with the state, but also their notion, their whole understanding of the state transcends many of the kind of rigid structures in which one often sets up the opposition between state and society. I don't think that's the way many of them thought, quite honestly.
And we'll talk more about this when we talk about your contributions specifically in the essay form as well. But Brooks, let's turn to you for a moment. Another one of the major themes that you both identify early on in the book is the importance of the formation of social communities, and specifically the significance of lay Buddhist and lay Buddhist associations. So can you speak a little bit to that, Brooks, sort of your sense of the importance of social communities and specifically lay Buddhist communities to the larger project that the volume is making clear for us?
Sure. Yeah. So this was one of the major themes that they came together when we put together all of the different essays. This is one of the major themes that emerged, and it runs sort of throughout the book. So not just in the early 20th century, but also running forward to Gareth Fisher's contribution for the contemporary period as well, with textual communities. So basically what we found was that so you had through the creation of lay organizations, lay associations, as you mentioned, they created new kinds of urban spaces, but also through sort of print enterprise as well, and the sort of flowering of a Buddhist print culture in the Republican era, which was also the basis for the kind of formation of new kinds of or Buddhist participation in new kinds of intellectual communities, such as Eric Hammerstrom looks at in the case of scientific discursive community in his chapter, that you, with this sort of Buddhist engagement with sort of new technologies of print, as well as the formation of associations and assembly and new kinds of urban space, that you really had basically Buddhist participation in the kinds of processes that that I think we see much more broadly. And one of the questions underlying this the whole project was, And this is one of the questions that my conversations with Jan sort of revolved around early on, as well as with the other contributors to the volume, was, so we keep seeing, so you have Buddhist presences in sort of significant areas that have been discussed by other scholars. So we're discovering Buddhists in all these different places, print culture, scientific communities, and the rest. But so can we go beyond just talking about sort of Buddhists were there too, right? To talk about sort of how this adding Buddhists to the story, or how the Buddhist presence in these different areas of, in this case, social community formation, how does it change the story in some sort of way? And so that was sort of what we were always kind of pushing for. I think in some cases, that conversation was more successful than in other cases, but I think there are some good examples in the book of that. I think Eric Hammerstrom's chapter, for example, does a very good job of showing how Buddhists bring different kinds of positions and ideas in the sort of domestication of science as an idea and as an ideology in the Republican era. So I think that that ended up being one of the major themes that came out of our conversations when we put all of this different scholarship together.
Jan, is there anything that you wanted to add to this conversation specifically on the importance of social communities and perhaps lay Buddhist communities specifically?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was such a revelation. It's almost as if the entire vision that I had of places like Shanghai, and for instance, when I was a graduate student, the main focus of a lot of the work that was going on among my peers and my professors was a Shanghai-based project, a lot of work on the city of Shanghai, and terrific work and still state of the field sort of work. And seeing as I did my own work, that there was this entire religious dimension, especially the Buddhist dimension, that was missing. It's as if you'd study New York City without understanding the importance of Judaism or Catholicism. I mean, you would just miss so much. It would seem absurd to people who study a place like that, that they would you would see it that way. So I think it's enormously significant, and it's significant not only for a place like Shanghai, but for the entire, the focus now in a lot of the research is on the Republican period, but increasingly as I'm involved in this work, this is going to extend to the entire 20th century. There's not going to be, the so-called Maoist gap is also a period in which there was a lot of religious life. And it's just because it had to be carried on in quietly, as you can see in Necky Jiang's chapter. There are people who, when they could go on doing what they sought to do, did so. And there's increasing evidence as more work comes out on that.
So let's actually get into the parts of the book. The book has three parts, and the first part is called Republican Era Modernity. So this part of the book looks at Buddhist engagement with important aspects of the emerging Chinese modernity of the early 20th century. And it has three chapters that Brooks has actually, I think, kind of nicely touched on already in brief ways, that look at the ways that various types of Buddhists positioned themselves as participants in the words of the book, the modern city, debates about science, and the publishing industry. And in doing so, it looks at how they contributed to producing important new forms of sociocultural identities, of communities, and of discourses. And Brooks, your chapter is actually part of this first part of the book. So let's talk briefly about this before moving on. This chapter looks specifically at something called the World Buddhist Householder Grove in early Republican Shanghai. So for listeners who have no idea what this is, let's kind of start at the beginning and then move our way to something more specific. So first, what is a householder and what was this World Buddhist Householder Grove?
Great. So householder, this is basically a standard translation for a Chinese term, zhishi, which is one of the terms for lay Buddhist that has a whole sort of complicated etymology that goes back to the translation of Buddhist scriptures. But essentially, it's one of the general terms for a lay Buddhist, a non-monastic affiliated Buddhist. And so the householder grove, so this is basically something new. This was basically the concept was that this would be a essentially a the person who founded it basically had taken the idea that so monasteries, right, were supposed to had their historical role within Buddhism. One of their historical roles was to sort of serve as a site of propagation. And so this behind this is sort of new ideas about, you know, what a religion is and what a religion does. But his idea was that monasteries in China had given up this role. And so the idea was that lay people needed to take this up. Right, so created what was essentially a lay version of sort of what he thought that a monastery should do in terms of propagation, and so this householder grove was kind of a new creation, new kind of Buddhist institution in the 1920s, so it was lay managed. The membership was entirely lay, although they brought in sort of eminent monks to give lectures and to lead sort of the study and discussion of scripture and for other sorts of things as well. So there was monastic involvement, but this was basically a new form of lay organization that emerged in Shanghai in the 1920s.
So in the chapter, you talk about the rise of this particular form of identity among urban elites in early 20th century Shanghai, and you talk specifically about the space of the compound of this World Buddhist Household or Grove. Now, you talk about this, and this I think is really interesting, and it speaks to something that you mentioned very briefly before. You talk about this being important in terms of how we understand the spatial construction of householder identity in Shanghai, and more broadly, the emergence of new types of urban religious space. So because this is something that I think is it's pretty clear, this is a contribution not just to how we understand this particular group, but perhaps how we think about space and an urban setting and its relationship to religious organizations more broadly. Can you talk about this particular aspect of the contribution, the emergence of new types of urban religious space in this context, and what you take to be perhaps most important about that?
Sure. Yeah. So this was this chapter. In this chapter, I was really sort of revisiting this organization that I had kind of started with in my dissertation research. And one of the questions that my advisor Wen Qianye had asked me, I guess it was sort of a question. She had asked me, so yes, there's a lot of continuities in terms of what these Buddhists are doing in the 1920s and 30s in Shanghai. But even if they were practicing sort of similar traditions, right, to what had come before, those kinds of practices must have meant something different. The Buddhist affiliation, you know, how did it mean something different and to practice all sorts of different Buddhist rituals and traditions in the specific context of early 20th century Shanghai. So it was this question of meaning and identity that I had been grappling with and that I wanted to think through in this chapter. And the way I wanted to do that was in terms of thinking about the space that they created through the construction of these of this organization in particular. Like others, I'm not thinking about urban space solely in terms of physical space, but also in terms of the kinds of practices through which individuals gave meaning to that space. And so for these particular individuals, for these lay Buddhists, what I found was that the practices through which they gave meaning to this organization as sort of a urban social space set up a whole series of sort of associations and differentiations with other kinds of urban spaces within Shanghai. And so sort of at one pole, you had the kind of commercial spaces on Nanjing Road symbolizing a kind of commercialized modernity. And on the other hand, you had the other pole, you had sort of the traditional Buddhist temples in the city. And so the lay Buddhists in this organization had sort of constructed the space of the organization, the physical space, and given it meaning in reference to these sort of two kind of reference points within the urban environment.
So the piece, before we move on, I'll just also mention for listeners, the piece also talks about one of the many reasons why this particular case is important more broadly, and that is it becomes a model for similar associations that grow up around China. So this becomes kind of something that disperses in, I think, a really interesting way. And you also talk about the fundamental ambivalence of the kind of modernity that emerges here. So there's all of that and more. happening just in the first chapter of the book. And that's one of many chapters. Part one of the book also includes a chapter on Buddhist intellectuals in the science and philosophy of life debates. And this is something that listeners who had a chance to hear my interview with Eric Hammerstrom will kind of recognize from that book. And also there's a chapter on Chinese Buddhist periodicals in the early republic by Gregory Adam Scott. Okay, but there's a whole second part of the book as well. And Jan, now we're going to, if you're still with us, I know it's 2 a.m. for you, you poor thing, but we're going to turn to part two right now. So part two looks at the Buddhist presence in modern politics and the expansions in state power through war and revolution in the middle of the 20th century. And this chapter, or this part of the book, also includes three chapters, and one of them is Jan's contribution. This is chapter six, and it deals with Buddhism in Suzhou in the early PRC. So, Jan, we've talked a little bit already about the importance of kind of discovering important archival records for you, and how that brought you into, a particular kind of engagement with an excitement about the field. And this chapter very much emphasizes the importance of a particular kind of archival records from the early 1950s in kind of opening up the case study here. So let's start there. Can you talk about the importance of the source base for this chapter and the kinds of things that that source base let you do in terms of telling this story about Buddhism in Suzhou in this period?
Yeah, so this was a bit lucky. I like a lot of work in Chinese archives. And it just happened to, I did realize I needed to poke into some of the Buddhists that I was interested in that were moving into the greater Suzhou area between Suzhou and Shanghai. And I happened to run a student program in 2005 and then 2006 also in Suzhou. So I was there over extended, over a term and summer and so forth. So I had the time and the Suzhou archives at that time was also not the most accessible of archives, though it was a pretty good time generally for the archives, especially compared to now. But it's just one of those fortuitous things where I was, for all who work in archives or for those who don't, it's a little bit of a game of asking and looking for different types of documents that might be available. In that time, you're really looking at original materials as opposed to digitized materials or microfilm. Mm-hmm. And so it's the original documents, and there's you have to try to ask for all kinds of different types of things where simply my project made no sense to archivists, so it wasn't within the realm of what they were trained to understand. So you just have to keep on thinking of ways to, and Brooks has worked a lot in archives too as well, so he knows how this works. But the more you get away from the big, well-organized archives like Shanghai and so forth, it's a little more complex, and this was just very, very lucky. So one day they just dropped a big stack of materials on my table, and I realized pretty quickly what they'd done. They'd given me this entire campaign's set of materials, and I just started copying as fast as I could. Because you don't know how long you'll have access to the document. So you just have to work quickly and try to get all the information down. In that period, you weren't allowed to take photographs or anything like that, and photocopying was very limited. But I could see that this was a highly detailed account with all kinds of charts that had been filled out by people who were supposed to report at the end of particular periods on how the project was proceeding. So it was a highly precise account of, in effect, the dismantling of Buddhism in the city. And that's a very rare bit of archival material, especially for the 1950s. Once I had it, though, there's a lot of challenges, of course, to using archives. And I don't want to go into too much detail, but of course, as we all know, archives show you a lot of things, but they obscure a lot of things. They distort certain things. There are lots of different ways to read them. And so figuring out how to find all the possibilities of the kinds of stories you can see that come out of them takes a while and a significant amount of contextualization. One thing that was clear pretty quickly is that in the there are a lot of the broad themes that Holmes Welch had sketched out and that some Chinese writers, contemporary writers, mostly writing from Hong Kong in the 1950s, had recognized mostly because these were the policy statements about religion. Mm-hmm. And so you could tell from effectively from newspapers, from people who were leaving China at the time, and then also from the Buddhist periodicals that Xue Yu writes about, you could tell those kinds of shifts. But what struck me very quickly by looking at the actual campaign in its process was how much was happening in a very steady point-by-point approach to taking apart the institution that was really unrelated to the larger policy statements, the ups and downs and so forth, and the discussions that a lot of people have focused on in the past. Much of it was very straightforward Marxist-Leninist approach to taking apart the economic basis of religion, because religion doesn't have a role really within the Marxist-Leninist view. And that was the approach. And it was very steady and very strategic. And it used a certain amount of what we recognize as Maoist campaign and thought reform techniques and so forth. But largely, it was about delegitimizing every type of economic, financial support for all Buddhist institutions step by step, and moving all monks and nuns effectively into productive laboring roles, or they'd have to do something else. And a very notable part of these charts was that they kept recording how many people were leaving the clergy, but there was no recording of how many people were joining the clergy. So there was no expectation that anyone would join the clergy. It was, in effect, I thought, proving quite effectively that this was not necessarily what some of the United Front overt policies talked about at the time. And this is an area, I should say, that is some debate with some of my friends and colleagues. But having looked at these documents, I feel that this one local case shows it pretty well for this one location, certainly. But it showed a lot more to me. And among the things that it showed is the details, if read in context, told a very particular – Buddhism didn't have a general story. It had a very particular story in Suzhou that wasn't necessarily what we might call an ancient story, but a reconstruction story at the local level after the Taiping wars and destruction and occupation of Suzhou in the mid-19th century. And in the 1920s and 30s, by a particular revivalist Pure Land monastic lay movement that was led by a master Yingguang who's enormously influential still in Chinese Buddhism, and I've written more about since, and is also very tied in with the group that Brooks has been writing about. But this was a movement that was very well organized, had a very charismatic leader, had huge numbers of very wealthy elite supporters, but also massive numbers of popular supporters from not only the region, but all over China and overseas Chinese communities. So this was a big, very influential movement. And one of the things that it was most effective at, as Rebecca Nettestuff had noticed about the particular monastery where they were based in the 1930s, is how effective they were at working with the state and how they negotiated so successfully that relationship in this period. And yet, simultaneously, while they represented a kind of, at one level, the cutting edge of a kind of modernized Buddhism, they were, under this monk's influence, extremely tolerant of the wide range of popular religious practice, including many things that Buddhist organizations, certain Buddhist progressives or radicals, and certainly secularists would have wanted to eliminate as superstitions. Mm-hmm. So that was a whole side of the story that became clear through a lot of the details in the dismantling. You could see what had been there in the past. On the other side of it, you could see what was left at the end And the kind of Buddhism that was in place by the end of this process, especially by 1954-55, I argue, is the state-structured Buddhism that was revived in the late 1970s. And as much as the reform-era Buddhism often represents itself as reconnecting to the Republican era, certainly the state-structured Buddhism of the mid-1950s is the initial model that is reestablished in the late 70s and early 80s. And there's a lot of evidence, if you can look at what that precisely looks like at the end of this campaign in the mid-1950s from the archival documents, and then what it looks like in the 1980s, you can see that. And as I argue, of course, there have been a lot of influences since the 1980s coming from outside of China, within China, that are not just state, as our volume shows as well, but that the state imprint of the reconstruction under the United Front and the Chinese Buddhist Association, which is a Chinese Communist Party government society, in effect, is extremely strong in establishing Buddhism in China. And I think that is still important to looking at the role of Buddhism in China today.
Great. Thank you so much. And the chapter really emphasizes some of what you've already said, right? The importance of the fact that this is not a simple story about continuity of Buddhist practice and Buddhism in this context. There's a lot of important change. And you also emphasize the importance of the research into specific contexts, into localities, local cultures, and practices of Buddhism in understanding modern China. And so there's a lot more that we could talk about in this chapter, just in this chapter, but we won't in the service of moving on and coming to our conclusion. I just want to mention for listeners that this part of the book, part two, also includes a chapter on the modern travels of a medieval monk resurrecting Xuanzang. This is by Benjamin Brose. And it also includes a chapter by one of the scholars that you've both mentioned already, Xue Yu, on Buddhist efforts for the reconciliation of Buddhism and Marxism in the early years of the People's Republic of China. There's also a whole third part of the book, right, that we won't have a chance to talk about too much, but this is part three. And I just want to mark this for listeners. This is a part of the book that includes two chapters that collectively offer ethnographic accounts of contemporary Buddhist practices, especially in groups that were left marginalized by economic reforms in the post-Mao era. Okay, so both of you, there's a million billion things that we could talk about, right? There's a lot more in the volume, and we've come to the end of our hour. But given that, is there anything in particular that didn't come up, but that either of you would like to mention for listeners? And Brooks, perhaps we'll start with you. Anything you want to get on the table that didn't come up?
I don't think so, Ash. I think we've covered quite a lot. I mean, there's as you said, there's much more. There's much more in the volume, particularly in the individual chapters. But I think we've done. I think you did a good job in asking questions that hit the major themes. So I will yield my time to Jan.
Hey, Jan, anything else that you want to get on the table that didn't come up?
I'd just like to add that, both one of the limitations of the volume, but also I think one of the things I also feel good about is that I see it, and I think Brooks and I both saw this very much as just a departure. And some of the early comments and reviews have also noticed this as well. And this is just a taste. This is, from my perspective, this is just some of the exciting stuff that's been percolating up, and we've been trying to pull it together to understand how significant it is, and we believe it is so, but it's really just the beginning. And from my position, sort of looking back on this whole project, I can't wait to see all the books that are going to be produced by not only the people in this volume, but there are lots of other people that we now know about who are working in this field. And there's so much more new work to be done. I have graduate students here who have responded to our volume and said, I completely disagree with that aspect of the volume. I'm going to do something else and look for another perspective. And I celebrate that as well. I mean, this is really just starting out, excavating. And there are some tremendous new materials that we can look at that are not necessarily the kind of difficult archives that I was talking about. But lots of, there's just such been a, such an explosion of documentary materials and opportunities to do field work as well. So I can't wait for the next 10 years to see what happens.
So Jan, let's stay with you. Now that the book is out, and congratulations on the volume, what's currently occupying you now? What's next, and kind of what are you inspired by at the moment?
So I've really been interested in local history, and as I mentioned at the outset, and I've been doing field work. I think what's really driving my fascination with field work and specificity is my a concern as I get to be an older historian as about problems of abstraction in dealing with history and the comfort that we all often have as historians in making big claims. And so I think one way to, of course, it's got its own problems, but I found it very rewarding to burrow deeply into the 20th century history of a few small places and to try to keep all these different elements that I've been interested in for quite a while alive in that. And as I said before, it's just a beginning project, but it includes a lot of religion, but it includes a lot of other aspects of local life that I think are also often ignored in the big narratives, but have to be put back in. And so that's what I'm working on.
So, Brooks, what are you working on now? What's next for you now that, that the volume is out?
Well, one of the things that that really fascinated me in looking at these what these Buddhists were doing in Shanghai had to do with their involvement in animal protection. It was one of the sort of biggest areas of their civic activism in the 1930s. They poured a lot of resources into it, and it was yeah, it was a very interesting area because they were sort of in a frenemy kind of relationship with a foreign group in Shanghai as well. It was also involved in animal protection, and so this was something that really kind of interested me. So I've been sort of digging more into that idea of sort of how human-animal relations, sort of opening that up a little bit and trying to think more about how human-animal relations were changing, particularly in urban environments in the 20th century, and going back to that question of urban space and how basically the sort of idea of what is sort of modern urban space, what is different about the urban environment and the experience of urban life has something fundamental to do with a relationship not only to the natural world in general, but also specifically to animals. And so animal protection is sort of part of that. But then I've also sort of become interested in all these different aspects of it recently. I need to figure out a way to sort of narrow it down. But, you know, sort of the modernization of slaughterhouses, the sort of bifurcation of animals into basically pets and strays or really, you know, kind of vermin and all sorts of different aspects of this changing relationship when you start to think about it. It really kind of opens up. And for me, it's fascinating. So I'm, again, like I'm sort of in the beginning stages of sort of thinking through where I want to take this. But that's what I've been thinking about a bit recently.
Well, thanks to both of you for taking time out of that work to talk with me about this one. And also, again, for being so generous about navigating time zones with me. It's really been a pleasure, and best of luck on the work to come. Thanks for being part of the podcast.
Thanks very much, Carla. This was terrific. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Carla.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very, very much for joining us on the podcast, and we'll catch you next time.